give the audience the kind of information they need to know about the prison movement in Black August. And I'm speaking from my own personal experience, and those are where the credentials come from, because I'm not talking about anything that I've heard or read about, but this is what I myself have gone through, and I'm still focused on. And if we're going to talk about Black August, then since I am considered a Black August historian, then my obligation first is to give some history. And before I talk about Black August, I want to talk about the prison movement, okay, and its content and its membership and its history before we get into Black August, because that will tell you why Black August. And roughly, I want to say that starting back as far as your mid-50s, mm-hmm, going into the mid-50s, when Malcolm was your lead spokesman and representative for the Nation of Islam, you had Black prisoners in every prison in the country who were either part of the Nation of Islam or, mm-hmm, like, I met a cat in 1964 named Dice. I met him in San Diego. And he told me he had come out of Sing Sing, and when he was in Sing Sing, he was involved with the School of African Nationalism. Mm-hmm. He's the first guy I ever heard speak Swahili. Mm-hmm. I said, School of African Nationalism, what's that? Mm-hmm. And then he told me that was one of the groups that was inside Sing Sing, and he, mm-hmm, told me you had Malcolm Muslims, Elijah Muslims, you had the African Nationalists. Later on in Quentin, I met a cat that called himself an African Zionist, and he come out of that.
Like Hebrew Israelite movement?
I don't know about that, but he said African Zionist, and it wasn't a Hebrew Israelite movement. It was, uh-huh, he was an African Zionist.
Returning back to Africa.
Yeah.
Okay.
He was an African patriot. Yeah. And so, you know, there were a lot of study groups, and these, mm-hmm, study groups developed schools of thought. Mm-hmm. Those schools of thought developed cadres. Those cadres developed their own movements. So they had their own way of educating each other one-on-one, mm-hmm, each one teach one, then developing a study group, school of thought, and a regimented group of people who would carry on this whole line of thinking, teaching, building on the concept, and then getting people involved in doing something. Mm-hmm. Okay, about it. So you were either going to make your contribution and your commitment as an African patriot to the African continent, mm-hmm, okay, or you were going to work throughout the diaspora, mm-hmm, okay. You were either going to focus here in this country, or maybe you would go to any other country where our community was, and then you were going to make your commitment there. But you had to find out how to get more than just a lip service, you know. So we were taking up trades and stuff, mm-hmm, and we said we would specialize in a trade so that we can get out, and as a tradesman you could take that trade back into your community wherever you were, either in Africa or here in this country, or if you decided to go into the Caribbean or go into Latin America and find the African community there. But you had to make some kind of a contribution. So if, mm-hmm, you're going to help build some kind of an economy there, mm-hmm, if you're going to help try to build some kind of an infrastructure there, mm-hmm, you see what I'm saying? You're going to take whatever skills were necessary that we called nation building skills, because, mm-hmm, just sticking your fist in the air was not enough. Mm-hmm. People had to have nation building skills in order to find themselves welcome someplace else, or you were just a surplus human body that had to be taken care of, and really you was a nuisance. Mm-hmm. And so we were serious. We weren't only interested in building cadres that could support national networks or community networks. We, mm-hmm, were trying to build national leadership. We saw ourselves as being the ones who would take over some kind of authority position and take the responsibility of actually serving the needs and organizing and moving an entire nation of people forward. And we were following the likes of people like Lumumba, mm-hmm, okay, and Kenyatta, and Ben Bella, mm-hmm, and Nkrumah, mm-hmm, and Sekou Touré, mm-hmm, You mm-hmm. see what I'm saying? Followed them closely and stuff. These guys weren't a lot older than we were. Mm-hmm. You know, when Gaddafi became the leader of Libya, he was mm-hmm. only, what, 4 or 5 years older than us. So he was still a young man. He was only about 28 years old. Mm-hmm. We were in our 20s. Mm-hmm. So we didn't see that this was unlikely for us mm-hmm. to have the same kind of responsibility. So we had to train ourselves as tradesmen. We had to train ourselves as organizers. We had to train ourselves as statesmen and be mm-hmm. able to speak and act mm-hmm. as a statesman and understand the responsibilities of statehood. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? If you're going to talk about independent mm-hmm. nations, you're going to have to act like a free man, an independent man. Mm-hmm. And so you can't stay on your knees and come as a beggar to the rest of the world. And if you're going to sit at a table anywhere in the world where decisions are being made about your people, mm-hmm. then you want to sit there at least as an equal. So you've mm-hmm. got to have an equal kind of skills mm-hmm. to share in an equal kind of responsibility. And this is where we was coming from with inside the prisons. Mm-hmm. And so this is how we were thinking, and this is what we were training ourselves to be those kind of individuals. This was not a game with us. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't about publicity, and it wasn't about just some kind of fad. Mm-hmm. You know, we were deadly serious about this, ready to give our all for this kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, in the 50s, mm-hmm. the main focus was on religious freedoms because yeah. Islam was considered not a true religion. When I stepped into Tracy in 1966, mm-hmm. you know, I was told that Muslims were contraband. And so if you wanted to practice any kind of spiritual mm-hmm. development, okay, you couldn't get any kind of instruction. You weren't allowed to have a Quran. You weren't allowed to have a prayer rug or a kufi or a place to meet. You could mm-hmm. only go to religious services in a Catholic or a Protestant chapel inside the prisons. Mm-hmm. And they would not open up any areas. So we used to take over the libraries. We would send brothers in to take over the tables and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then they would have the minister, assistant minister, secretary, and the captain's table. Mm-hmm. Okay, the lieutenants would have tables, and the squad leaders would take the information and everything that was sent down from the brass table, from the minister's table, and then they would dispense that information to the rank and file and mm-hmm, stuff. And mm-hmm. so we did it on a very orderly level. Mm-hmm. So Muslims fought for religious rights. Mm-hmm. So that meant that everybody from the early 1950s until 1968 who came into prison and joined the Nation of Islam, each individual filed a $6 million lawsuit against the state of California
each
for denying
individual?
Every individual. So you mm-hmm. got a religious rights movement because mm-hmm. you're doing something about
right.
it.
Yes, sir.
You're building a machine that's going to bring about a desired result. So
almost
every
like
individual
action, huh? yeah.
put together, yes, every individual filed a class action lawsuit mm-hmm. against the state of California, mm-hmm. naming the governor and everybody that worked under him, which meant the director of the Department of Corrections, his assistant, all the way down to the warden and every prison guard in the state of California that were responsible for suppressing and denying your right Mm-hmm. to practice your freedom of religion. In 1968, and everybody filed for $6 million. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so you demanded $6 million, okay? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In 1968, the Supreme Court of the land ruled that Islam is a true religion. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, and from that day forward, they started allowing Muslim ministers, if they were from the nation, or mm-hmm. imams, mm-hmm. okay, or anybody else that was someone who would officiate a religious mm-hmm. service, mm-hmm. okay, in the Islamic community, mm-hmm. allowed them to come into the prisons, mm-hmm. okay, to officiate over the services. Mm-hmm. From that day forward, Muslims or anybody who wanted to take up Islam mm-hmm. was allowed to have a Quran, a prayer rug, a kufi, and at the same time to observe Ramadan and even the dietary rules mm-hmm. of your religion. Prior mm-hmm. to that, they tried to force Muslims to eat pork.
I remember that. Yeah,
okay?
Yeah, yeah.
They used to put us in the hole and stuff. We used to learn how to fast for 30 days. We would eat toilet paper and wash it down with coffee just to keep our intestines running. Mm-hmm. Okay? And we wanted to prove to them because they told us, we're going to see if you believe in your God because we're going to starve you and the only thing you're going to have to eat is pork. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? And we defied them to the extent that they saw how serious we was, and they started gradually backing up off of us because they saw that they could not stop us. If they put us in the hole, mm-hmm. we turned the hole into a mosque. Mm-hmm. And everybody who come into the hole, we flipped them mm-hmm. and recruited them. You see mm-hmm. what I'm saying? And we stood them up. Mm-hmm. So that was how we carried about the religious rights movement. But mm-hmm. then there were other things like just the persecution. Mm-hmm. And the discrimination if you were black. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I was in Soledad, they were so bent on wiping out our, they didn't even want you to look, walk, talk, or even culturally preserve mm-hmm. your Africanness in mm-hmm. any kind of way. So we weren't allowed to wear naturals, mm-hmm. okay? They call them wrap brown haircuts or football helmets. If you wore braids, they said that those were weird and obnoxious hairstyles, and they would catch you, kidnap you, strap you down, and then they would cut the ends of the braids off so that you would have these square patches all over your head. You see what I'm saying? They built special barbershops where they would kidnap you and take you to that barbershop and cut you if you didn't have what was called a regulation haircut, which was a military-style haircut. Mm-hmm. You know, and so we had ways of dealing with that. Wherever we could and however we could, we would burn those barbershops down. Mm-hmm. Okay? Brothers would wear the braids so they couldn't see the length of their hair. Then on visiting day or on special days that we would do our own observances, they would blow their hair out. You mm-hmm. see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. If you walked in a group, they wouldn't bother you. But if you were by yourself, then they would just mob you, you know, and just drag you and take you somewhere. Like in San Quentin and B section, they had the gunman hold a gun on me while a barber sat in a chair, and he almost cried telling me he was out of San Francisco, and this was during the age of hair, and he was talking about how he loved my full head of hair, and many people on the streets of San Francisco would be proud to wear their hair like mine, mm-hmm. but this guy was forcing him to make me abide by the regulations, so he cut it. He didn't cut it all off, but he mm-hmm. cut it down significantly mm-hmm. and stuff mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. So we went through those kind of things. We had a movement that made sure that when black products started being made, when Proline come out, they mm-hmm. might have made most of their money, that they, if they couldn't get a lot of people out here to buy the products, they could get all of us to buy, because we were starving for them. Mm-hmm. I remember when we were in YA, man, the only thing we had to put in our hair was Brill Cream. Remember the Brill Cream? Man, yeah, Brill Cream, a little dab will do you. Yeah, and we would tell them a little dab won't do us, okay? Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. we would force them to allow us, wherever it was possible, mm-hmm. to get the black products that we were identified that were put together to meet our special needs mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. told them, you let the white boys have this and you let the Chicanos have that, you won't let us have what we got in this mm-hmm. country. Mm-hmm. So we started, same thing with films and movies. Mm-hmm. Started. So that's how we saw all the black so-called exploitation films in the penitentiary. Mm-hmm. And then I was able to get Crook and them to smuggle in through our organization mm-hmm. under some auspices, mm-hmm. stuff like Finally Got the News, mm-hmm. you know, and stuff like that, and stuff on Malcolm and stuff on what was going on inside the bush, the fighting in the bush inside Mozambique and stuff. I was able to get that kind of stuff mm-hmm. into mm-hmm. the penitentiary and show it to the brothers. Okay, so we built these organizations inside. So you had two types. You had underground organizations, but you had formal organizations that had to be recognized by the wardens and stuff. Mm-hmm. There, we would do our cultural affairs type mm-hmm. of thing. Mm-hmm. And that would allow us to have an outside link with scholars, somebody off of campus, mm-hmm. ideologues, you understand mm-hmm. what I'm saying, mm-hmm. and stuff like that, who could make us, get us in contact with the revolutionaries on the street, the revolutionary-minded people on the mm-hmm. street. So we contributed articles to the Black Digest when that was going back in those mm-hmm. days, remember? Mm-hmm. And the mm-hmm. black scholar.
Yeah.
We contributed articles to that. I personally wrote articles. I was given a page inside the Berkeley Barb, the Berkeley Tribe, the Black Panther Party, and the Communal News Service, the Guardian, which later became the National Guardian, which later mm-hmm. became the Guardian. So mm-hmm. I had articles in those papers, because I ran in Soledad a newspaper, an underground paper called the Black and Brown Underground. Sometimes mm-hmm. we called it Mano a Mano. Mm-hmm. When I got to San Quentin, I put together a press called the San Quentin Underground Free Press. Mm-hmm. Okay, and what I basically was doing was explaining all of the tension that was building up inside mm-hmm. and how they were suppressing us and how they were trying to repress the movement and how they were trying to keep us from building the movement, etc. Mm-hmm. And the methods that they were using, the kidnaps, the detentions, the tortures inside, okay, mm-hmm. the bogus beefs that they was giving. In other words, they was taking us through the same thing. At the same time, the FBI was making war against the Black Panther Party, against SNCC, and against all the organizations out here on the street, mm-hmm. Republic of New Africa. The same time that they were moving on them, they moving on us, and we're in the prisons. Yeah, and we had the distinction of being the only revolutionaries in the world who would started their movement and their activities while they were yet detained. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I contend that the group that I came up with is paramount to the militant wing of the imprisoned ANC members mm-hmm. that Mandela belonged to while he was in prison. Mm-hmm. And we carried out the same kind of struggle. The only difference was we didn't have so much of an official voice in the national representation of our people in this country, but we did have a voice. Mm-hmm. And we had a voice that everybody did listen to, because there was a time when things were going so bad out here that they started looking toward political prisoners who were locked up for the answers to the contradictions out here. Mm-hmm. Remember that? Remember. And they were looking forward to us coming out. You see what I'm saying? And being the vanguard leadership. Yeah. And so that's why they even embraced the statement that Ho Chi Minh when the prison gates are open, the real dragon will come out. Yeah, you dig what I'm saying? And we were the dragons that were supposed to come out, join the Red Army, and take up the leadership of the movement and work with an already established leadership. You see what I'm saying? And fill in those ranks of those who had either been kidnapped, sent into exile, or murdered. And we were the ones supposed to step into their positions and fill that gap and bring back the momentum and intensify the struggle out here in this country. Mm-hmm. Okay? So the other things that we did, we fought within the labor movement inside the prisons, which meant they got this slave labor going on inside. Well, we challenged their right to exploit our labor. Mm-hmm. We challenged their right to pay us no more than 2 cents, 4 cents, 12 cents, 16 cents at a maximum, and none of us would get that. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? That was the wages, all right? Then they had us doing this real labor. I'm talking about, I worked in the clothing industry. Mm-hmm. And so the way that I sabotaged their efforts to totally exploit us and use us as a cheap labor force was by organizing work strikes, okay, setting forth certain demands about our rights, whether it be religious rights or whether we wanted them to discontinue the discrimination and the persecution of our people inside the prisons. For one thing, they were making us do 2 and 3 times more time, okay, on our sentences for the same offenses that other people had. Mm-hmm. So we would always do 2 or 3 times more than anybody else. We were more likely to receive a death penalty and have the execution actually carried out than anybody else. And while we were in there, man, when I said that they didn't want us to even maintain our cultural identity, there's a brother named Joe Shaw that was walking down the hall in Tracy, and he had this hip walk where he's walking on his toes and he's bouncing and he's slinging his arm over his head. They locked him up for 6 months and said that the manner in which he carried himself down the hall was inciting a riot. Mm-hmm. When I pierced my ear in the shoe shop in Tracy, I got locked up for self-mutilation and was accused of trying to start a weird and obnoxious cult. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So if you wore your head bald, we were not allowed to do anything in unity where we all looked alike, we all carried ourselves in the same way. You know, they even took the drums from us, and we were there playing Congo drums. They said we were sending war messages from one end of the penitentiary to the other one. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And that frightened them, so they took the drums out. See, so anything that was peculiar to us, our culture, our history, they had to wipe that out. They did not want you to walk, think, or act like yourself, your historical self. It's just like Kunta Kinte. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Okay, now, the other thing that they had a habit of doing, these are mostly farmers and rural type of people who worked in these prisons, who didn't grow up in an urban complex. Mm-hmm. And so whenever they saw us on television, they didn't live around a lot of blacks. And whenever they seen us on television, they saw these big naturals and they saw guns. Mm-hmm. So when we wore naturals in the penitentiary, they automatically seen the guns. Mm-hmm. So they would call you into these committee rooms and they would ask you stuff like, what do you feel about Martin Luther King? They wanted you to denounce him, because if you said you thought he was a hell of a contributor to our cause, then of course they were going to persecute you for that. Mm-hmm. All right? You were going to be branded and they were going to be targeted for day-to-day harassment, day-to-day torment, mental and physical torment, all right? And they were going to give you the worst of everything and every kind of treatment. Mm-hmm. If you said that you liked Stokely Carmichael, they knew Stokely because they saw him on TV all the time, so they knew his name and they knew his face. So they would ask you, what do you think about this guy Stokely Carmichael? Mm-hmm. You know, and the insinuation is, you better not say you appreciate him in no kind of way, because we're going to move on you. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So these are the kinds of things they were doing. So they had brothers so terrified that they wouldn't look them in the eye. The brothers would look down at their feet. And that's one of the things that Bunchy moved on brothers about. He said, man, we catch you guys, man, not squaring your shoulders and looking these guys, this white man in his face, man, looking right in his eyes and talk to him like you're a man. We catch you cowering before him with your shoulders over your, hunched up around your ears and your head down and scratching your head. Say, man, we going to move on. You see what I'm saying? So what you got to do is you got to stand there firmly and represent the strength that runs throughout our line. Because if you show weakness, they going to move on all of us. If you show strength, then they're going to see the strength in all of us, and that's going to back them up. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So our job as a movement was not only to represent our people inside these places, okay, but at the same time to look out for the well-being of all of us. Mm-hmm. They were murdering us every day, man. They were sending us out the back door in a hearse, man. Mm-hmm. And then they would send a message home to that cat's mother saying he died in some homosexual affair or that he died in some gambling debt, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. When in reality what they was doing, they put him in the hole. And they would let these racists down in the hole, the prisoners, They let them antagonize him all night long, talking about how we're going to kill all of y'all, just like they killed the Jews in Europe. And we're going to use your hair like steel wool to clean our toilets with. And they're making these Rama the Jungle sounds. They let them feed you. So when they come time to stick a tray into your cell, then it's got pee in it. In your food, or it's got glass in your food, or it's got feces in your food. And when you come out the cell during exercise and you want to attack and fight the guy that did you like this, they done gave him real knives. The police done brought him knives from the street. You understand what I'm saying? So now here's five of them armed with real knives that either they got from the streets or they're allowed to come in from the kitchen. So we had to set up a mechanism to deal with that. We had to set up a mechanism that would that would actually discourage this kind of stuff. You understand what I'm saying? This is what the movement is about. At the same time, we're strengthening brothers instead of weakening them. And we're giving them a sense of who they are. And we're giving them books and material to read. And we're trying to tell them how to take advantage of these trades and how we're going to use this as a university to educate ourselves. And when we go back, we're going to be an asset rather than a liability. They found out they couldn't recycle us. So we was undoing what they was trying to do, which was use this as a feeding pen to feed our whole community one at a time, like cattle. You know what I'm saying? Being herded up the ramp going to slaughter. And so this is what they wanted to do. We're setting up a mechanism where you can't recycle these people. So if you can't recycle us, then they can't have what they call job security. You understand what I'm saying? So they had to find a way to stop this. So I had sent out a document that was stolen from the warden's desk, where somewhere in the Bureau of Prisons and somewhere at the top of the Department of Corrections, they had circulated a memo to all the wardens saying, we have now a new kind of prisoner. And they were saying he's the kind of prisoner that blames society rather than himself, okay, for being in these prisons. He's saying the social contradictions are what led him to getting involved in the kind of desperate activities that led him being captured and brought to the penitentiary. We cannot afford to allow him to spread this philosophy while he's in prison, and we can't afford to let him out while he still holds to that belief. So then they started talking about what they would do with us. So besides targeting us and segregating us and isolating us from other prisoners so that we couldn't spread this idea and philosophy, they was also talking about, in a very sophisticated way. They didn't come straight out in bold print and say this, but it was almost like reading a Nazi document about the final solution. They were very seriously suggesting that we couldn't be allowed to influence prisoners while we were in prison. We couldn't be allowed to go home as long as we held these revolutionary beliefs. Okay, and at the same time, there was actually no place for us because there was no way to contain us, there was no way to discipline us, there was no way to change us, and they had to figure out how to eliminate us without at the same time being accused of it. And without having to pay for it. You understand what I'm saying? So what happened after that, they built a death list in Sacramento. And this death list was comprised of all of us that they could identify from one prison to another. Throughout California, who could be identified as being involved in this same militant black movement, who were organizing and spreading this militancy, spreading this hostile attitude towards authority. Like I told you, when they had us in the workshops and when I was working in the clothing industry, I couldn't get everybody to do it. But the way I sabotaged the workforce was I destroyed the clothing we had to work on. For instance, if we were making trousers, I instructed dudes to sew the pockets inside out and the zippers upside down. And so we would do thousands of pairs of trousers like that. Then when we go to lunch and we had to stack these things, you know, by the hundreds, you know, the way we would burn them down was I'd take a cigarette that was already lit, put it inside a book of matches, put it under the whole stack of material. Then when we go to lunch, the cigarette burns down, it ignites the matches set the clothing on fire, so we didn't burn up a lot of their money. You understand what I'm saying? Okay, then the work strikes were another way of sabotaging their money because they made hundreds of thousands of dollars off of us per week, and they put this stuff on the board. Then they would have us work at night and give us bonus pay because they wanted to meet these $1 million objectives. You see what I'm saying? You know, the goal was this month to make over $1 million. And at night when they would have us work, they would bring people in from the street and they'd walk around, they would show off the factory, they would show us off. We'd be working. Everybody else is in the bed sleeping. They got us in there working in the middle of the night. So if you do a work strike, a work stoppage, and you stop this production line, okay, then you cost them untold amounts of money. So mm-hmm. when we were getting ready to demand that they not execute somebody, to demand that they release somebody from the hole, to demand that they quit putting us in the hole for educating ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me disconnect this phone, man. Wait a second.
Readies. Hello. Not here. Not really. I'm ready to take off. Thank you. Just call back later on, okay? Oh, how you doing? Yes, this is how you doing, Benita.
So just pick up where we left off?
Yeah.
So, like, if we were going to put forth a set of demands, then you had to find a way to reinforce those demands.
Mm-hmm.
Other words, if those demands aren't met, then you're going to face a certain type of action from us that, mm-hmm. you know, that you don't like.
Mm-hmm.
So other words, it's just like imposing some kind of sanctions upon them. You see what I'm saying? We're going to show them the level of uncooperation we're going to put forth. Aside from not cooperating with them, there are other things that we could do.
Mm-hmm.
You see what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying? Where we could launch full-out attacks to try to dismantle this whole prison system.
Mm-hmm.
And so some of us were actually on that page. So you had some people, man, who just wanted reforms.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had to put forth demands to satisfy them, to get them to join us.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to appeal to their need for certain reforms.
Mm-hmm.
Those reforms were the kind of things that would make life more tolerable inside a prison.
Yeah, like a united front of the different
Well,
drums.
yeah. In order to shut that prison down
mm-hmm.
for a minute, you had to have the cooperation of the entire prison population. Okay. What they would do normally, the administration, is when we would come forth with a set of demands and say we wanted a strike and we're going to mm-hmm. try to shut the joint down, they would just tell the white boys, well, you know, all they're looking for is a black warden. No, and the white boys don't want to be under no black warden. You understand mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Or something like that, man.
Mm-hmm.
And then they would try to turn it into a race riot.
Mm-hmm.
So if they got us fighting against ourselves, then we can't fight against them.
Mm-hmm.
You see? So however they could do it, they can turn clique against clique, ethnic group against ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same thing. One way or another, it's one convict or a group of convicts against another group of convicts, and now the convicts are bickering amongst themselves instead of challenging the real enemy and the real cause of their anger and their frustration,
mm-hmm.
and that is the prison itself, and
mm-hmm.
the prison administration, and the rules and regulations of the prison, and the prison culture itself.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the things we did was create a revolutionary culture to combat prison culture.
Mm-hmm.
So all these other things that you would come in here and do, you know, talk, do your own time, don't think about the next man.
Mm-hmm.
We kill that and talk about, no, you live for the collective, you work for the collective, you are part of a collective body of people who live under the same rotten circumstances,
mm-hmm.
and you are going to work together to help each other survive this
mm-hmm.
this ordeal. You
mm-hmm.
see what I'm saying? And you're going to work against everybody else that is responsible for making sure that you suffer.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way you're not going to suffer is fight those who causing your suffering.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? So we had to identify how many ways you could do this.
Mm-hmm.
And then some of us had to be the one who led the way successfully so that the others would be encouraged to do the same
mm-hmm.
thing. Otherwise, mm-hmm. if they're terrified, they're like, I ain't going to do that stuff, man.
Mm-hmm.
I see what happened to you.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to know and we had to test. And there was a million ways we had to test these circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
Even in terms of trying to recruit people, we had secret screening committees where we would go into secret places in the prison and we would bring somebody in and sit there and we would hold counsel with that person and we would talk to them and we would talk to each other about what do we need to do to get people to identify, what symbols can we put out in the prison.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I'm saying? What things can we get them to identify? How can we get them to think on this level every day, day in, day out, instead of once a week when they go to these little prison sponsored meetings,
mm-hmm,
you know what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying, that the warden allows us to host. See, those
mm-hmm.
those were things we used those, but we didn't believe in that.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
this was a staging ground
mm-hmm.
where we did a whole lot of subversive stuff
mm-hmm.
through what we were allowed to do. You understand
mm-hmm.
what I'm talking
mm-hmm,
about?
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, as we continued to build this movement, we became more and more apparent to the prison authority because they kept seeing things going on. They saw bombs planted places that didn't go off. You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
They saw acts of arson being committed in the workplaces or in the administration buildings and
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. For I was involved in a plan to try to sink San Quentin at
mm-hmm.
one point.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and so there was certain ways that we were going to destroy the buildings and cause a flood inside the prison, and then actually try to sink the joint mm-hmm. after we liberated a certain number of prisoners. But we had other prisoners who were pro-prison and prison culture who responded on an emergency level to stopping the things that we were doing from actually being complete. So they mm-hmm. put out the fires and they went around and rescued the prison fortress mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. destruction, from mm-hmm. our intended destruction. You understand mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So anyhow, man. What I'm saying is we actually had a movement, mm-hmm. and it still exists. Mm-hmm. And so those of us who were foremost in pushing this movement and organizing others and who were the most active, mm-hmm. we wound up on these lists, on these death lists. Mm-hmm. And they systematically went about the process of eliminating us. Mm-hmm. The turning point was on January 13, 1970, when they killed three of us at one time mm-hmm. on the Old Wing Yard in Soledad. Mm-hmm. Okay, and within 3 days, after talk radio shows and even TV hosts like Mike Douglas and them that had these programs like Oprah has today, mm-hmm. you had a bunch of those programs. The host of all those programs wanted to know, how do you fire 4 shots into a prison yard to break up a fight amongst black, brown, and white prisoners? And wound one white from a ricochet and kill 3 blacks.
Who were the 3 blacks who were killed? What are they called?
Well, W.L. Nolan was the first one. Mm-hmm. Okay, was a very close comrade of George Jackson. He was mm-hmm. out of Oakland, California. Very, mm-hmm. very tough brother. And a very committed revolutionary mm-hmm. that they hated. Mm-hmm. They hated him. They shot him in the heart and killed him instantly. Mm-hmm. All right. The second shot ricocheted off the ground and hit the Aryan Brotherhood member Buzzard, who was attacking him and stood no chance of defeating him in a fist fight because mm-hmm. W.L. Nolan was the Marvin Hagler of the whole system. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. All right, and he was unafraid to fight while being shot at, and they knew this. Mm-hmm. And before they shot them brothers, they passed out flyers and leaflets a couple of days in advance saying they were going to let them out on the yard. They had finished building this gun tower over the yard. They were going to inaugurate the gun tower by letting them out on the yard that day. The warden, associate warden, lieutenants, and everybody else were standing there when they brought them out of the cells one by one, strip searched them, got them butt naked, put their clothes back on, and sent them out onto the yard. And so the white boys went in one area, the Chicanos went in another area, the brothers come out on the yard. They told this white dude, Buzzard, to go over there and swing on W.L. Nolan. He swung on W.L. That constituted the right to use the gun that they had put in the tower. They shot W.L. through the heart, bullet ricocheted, and knocked one of Buzzard's testicles off. Lil Jug from South Park, out the businessman, he was running towards W.L. He was either punching a bag or playing basketball, and he ran towards W.L. The third shot hit him. The fourth shot hit the brother out of Riverside County who was in there for shooting the police on the street. Mm-hmm. Let's see, it was W.L. Nolan, it was Lil Jug, his name was Cleveland Edwards, and then this other brother, I just can't think of his name right now, but he was out of Riverside. Well, Jug got shot in the leg. One of them got shot in the leg, the other one got hit in the side. Mm-hmm. Okay. The hospital ramp is on the yard. In other words, you got the building they come out of, which is the whole old wing. Then you had this little yard. On the other side, the adjacent wall is the hospital wall with a wheelchair ramp. Mm-hmm. When they stopped the fighting because 3 brothers went down, the first thing they did was got everybody else together, got them back into the building in the hole. Sent one group at a time, white, brown, black. Okay, these 2 brothers are bleeding to death in the meantime mm-hmm. on the yard, mm-hmm. right at the hospital ramp, mm-hmm. okay? Mm-hmm. Then they had to go and bring the rest of the prisoners from the main line back into their cells, from school, from the industries. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And then instead of taking these guys right into this ramp, they take them through the hole, through these locked gates, into the hallway, take them the long way around to the hospital. So mm-hmm. word comes back to the hole that all 3 of them are dead. Mm-hmm. Okay, that all 3 of them are dead. All right? Mm-hmm. 3 days later, on January 16, 1970, a grand jury decision comes back justifiable homicide. That night, a prison guard was thrown off the rail to his death mm-hmm. in retaliation. 3 brothers were assigned to stand trial for that, and that was John Cluche, Fleeta Drumgo, and George Jackson.
Soledad Brothers.
And they became the Soledad Brothers. Mm-hmm. All three of them are out of Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. The mothers tried to get all these different lawyers in L.A. to fight this case. None of them, this was like a Scottsboro boys mm-hmm. case. Mm-hmm. None of the black lawyers in Los Angeles, none of them, mm-hmm. none of them mm-hmm. wanted to have anything to do with defending three young black prisoners accused of killing a white prison guard. Mm-hmm. So white Jewish attorneys out of the Bay Area eventually took up the legal battle. Mm-hmm. You understand mm-hmm. what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And highly politicized it. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. Okay, that was the turning point in California for the California Department of Corrections, because we had in play a system that said 3-for-1. Okay, so when the first guard was down, a note was left on him. 2 more. You see what I'm saying? But in actuality, over a period of time, there had to be 9 because there was 3 down. And so there had to be at least 9 to go. And over a period of 10 or 18 month period, about that many were taken out.
Down, yeah.
But more brothers were killed in the process too. Mm-hmm. And more brothers were charged, and more brothers were going to trial, and more brothers were being tortured and beaten in order to try to put fear in the hearts of other prisoners so that they would not become mm-hmm. the same like-minded, the same like-acting type of prisoners. You mm-hmm. understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. After George's death on August 21st, 1971, after his death, there was some more activity, very intense activity inside the prison system. Okay, then a full-scale repression where they came on a witch hunt and they locked everybody they thought was organized along the same line, locked everybody down. By this time, FBI comes in not only to investigate, but to start to interrogate people and to put together a report, figure mm-hmm. out what's going on and who's who, and they try to figure out how they're now going to destroy the movement. So by 1978-79, that the brothers in the pen and the movement had become so despondent, you understand what I'm saying, and demoralized, mm-hmm. that it was necessary to find some way to revitalize their spirits and to get their recommitment to continue to move mm-hmm. forward, because the conditions were still the same, that our people were still being terribly brutalized in these closets, behind these closed doors and behind these immense walls where the public not only could not see, but where they could even lose interest and not even care what was going on to their brothers, fathers, sons, you understand what mm-hmm. I'm saying, mm-hmm. cousins and friends who had been captured and drugged to that side of the wall. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, they would give them comedy and music and sports and entertainment to keep them busy so they couldn't hear the screams. You understand what I'm saying? And they couldn't hear the screams of the torture, and they couldn't hear the repercussions mm-hmm. coming back. And they mm-hmm. didn't even see the smoke and the gas coming over the walls and the fires that we set. Mm-hmm. So we had to find a way to re-stimulate their interest in building a movement and continuing our efforts to make sure that they don't do us like this, that they don't commit crimes against humanity. Mm-hmm. Upon us. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know what I'm saying? They don't dehumanize us. And mm-hmm. so we're now not talking about a civil, but a human rights struggle being fought by prisoners to try to change the conditions so that anyone who will come behind us, we got to look at the fact that our little brothers are going to be coming in these penitentiaries one day. They stand a chance of coming in. Our sons and daughters mm-hmm. stand a chance of coming in. So for the sake of our children's children, the buck got to stop right here with us. Mm-hmm. And if we got to give our lives today to make sure that it doesn't go on, we are prepared to do that if that's what it takes to make sure that the safety and the well-being of our sons and daughters, you understand what I'm saying, mm-hmm. is in place. Mm-hmm. And so that's what Black August is about. Black August was created as a memorialization, a commemoration of those who had given their all already, and a way to rededicate yourself to the same struggle that is not over, so that we say the struggle continues mm-hmm. and geography makes no difference. Mm-hmm. It don't matter whether you're in this country or that country, whether you're on the streets or you're in prison, the struggle does continue, and that's what we want to remember, especially during the month of Black August. And that's why during that month they fast as a sacrifice, during that month as a commemorative sacrifice for those who've given their all. They make sure they don't horseplay, they don't bicker and fight amongst themselves. And George used to always say, settle your differences and come together and fight the common enemy. Mm-hmm. So one thing they have to do during Black August is make sure they don't get involved in these conflicts, interpersonal conflicts, group mm-hmm. to group or person to person. Mm-hmm. That's at this time you build and preserve the idea of unity mm-hmm. amongst us all. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And there are a number of other things that are done in that same spirit. So that's what Black August is about.
Okay. We can go on and we can chill because I know you have time issues and I don't want to drain you out too long, brother.
Well, I have a thing called the Black August Declaration. I don't know if I should read it.
No, go ahead, brother. Where did it come from?
Me.
Okay.
I wrote this. Read it out, brother. I wrote this years ago.
What year is it about?
Well, it was 23 years after 1970, so I wrote it in 1993 originally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's part of my book. It's one of it's a page out of my book. And how much time do we have?
We're cool. It's on you. I can sit here for hours, brother.
Well.
But it's on you.
I tell you what. Let me start from here. On August 21st, 1971, George Jackson died as he wanted, fighting for freedom and justice, dispatching his enemies, who dared deprive him of so much for so long, and who on that fateful day decided to climax this orgy of deprivation and pain with a plot to actually cut off his life. George had always promised that when the smoke cleared, they would have to count the bodies on both sides. It may stand outside the reasoning of some who don't want to admit it, and others who can't see what we would profit from it, but we are fighting a war to reclaim our birthright, our manhood, our dignity as human beings. At this stage, it is not so much what shall we profit from it, that others don't profit from the injustice they commit against us is the immediate point of all this. We have been kidnapped and murdered by every imaginable means and scattered all over the earth. We have been divided against ourselves. We have been dispossessed of our lands and culture and natural resources. We were separated from God and self. We were robbed of our identity and beaten and forced into schizophrenia. Now we live all over the world in other people's lands, under the laws of their national sovereignties, living as pawns and peons, being manipulated every day of our lives, always at a disadvantage, damned if and when we do, damned if and when we don't. We are told the only way out is to join our enemies, to aid and abet them in the containment, pacification, and destruction of ourselves, that there is no other way for us to profit. George Jackson preferred to do otherwise. Somewhere in our midst exists the likeness of George Jackson, who himself was the likeness of others before him, and even during his time. History has given us a sufficient number of them, although not enough of them are born at the same time. They seem to come and go during different periods, succeeding one another like chapters in a book. It is in accordance with nature. It is in accordance with nature that they will keep coming until the day when they are no longer when there is no longer a need for them. The Mother Earth produced them from within herself, expelling them from her womb like she does the fire and lava in a volcanic eruption. Within that incandescent mass of molten metal and rock is the wealth of the earth, and so among the great masses of people of the world, in every time and every place, comes the crown jewel of all of the earth's products, the liberator, the redeemer, the August night. And now, to all you enemies of the revolution, I want to put you on notice. This is the 37th year of the dragon, which dates back to the 7th of August, 1970, and we are still here. You cannot stamp out the desire for freedom that remains in the hearts of our people. You cannot root out the pockets of resistance to your oppression. You cannot legitimize your abuses of power and your crimes against humanity by describing us as something less than human beings. For all your lies and your spreading of misinformation, the truth continues to find its way to those among us who seek it. You are not out of the reach of justice and retribution. Behold, savage, our patience with you is running out. There is growing among us a new breed of young warriors who are not yet revolutionaries but are indeed the new resistance. They fear not and they care not about what happens today, tonight, or tomorrow. They are bound by nobody's restrictions and they play by nobody's rules. You have created the conditions for them to rise and multiply. And you will meet them wave after wave until your brutality is finally matched by them. and you are exhausted by the horrors of confrontation in this war of attrition that seems to have no end. And don't forget, the whole world will be watching. When George said to you, hurl me into the next existence, the descent into hell won't turn me, he meant the rest of us and our children's children's children. The desire for justice and freedom is a torchlight that can never be extinguished. When George said, I'll crawl back from the grave and dog your trail into the hereafter, he meant that even after our frontline soldiers have been vanquished and the dungeons you build for us are filled with our very best, there will be a lull and a period of inactivity. And then one day, it will seem that from out of nowheres and for no explainable reason, the outburst of rebellion and the rebirth of resistance will return and rush down upon you as if guided and carried by the wildest forces of nature. It is not the earthquake you must prepare for. George told you, we shall gather at your doorsteps in such a number that you will feel the earth tremble beneath our feet. All this and more is coming, we promise you, in the name of the revolution and those who lived and stood and died for it. And to the young brothers and sisters all over who might be standing in the shadows just listening, this is the hour of reckoning. This is the day of redemption. No one on earth can or will take up the fight for you but yourselves. Some of you know your backs are up against the wall. Settle your differences, as George said we should. Rush down upon those who stand between you and your freedom and get them out of your way. Join the revolution. It is your turn to write a page in history. Will your children's children be freer, or will they be more enslaved?
Okay, brother, man.
Cool, cool, cool.